Welcome to this new episode of The World According to Irina Zuckerman, our very special series on global politics on the KJ Masterclass Live. Irina Zuckerman is a US-based national security and human rights lawyer as well as a renowned geopolitical analyst. Her writings and commentary have appeared in diverse US and international media and have been translated to over a dozen languages. Every fortnight, in The World According to Irina Zuckerman, we traverse the geopolitical landscape and delve into pressing international issues and gain insight from Irina's expert perspective. Welcome to the show once again, Irina.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here as always.
Thank you. This is our sixth episode. And again, on this one, we have got several big topics, several things have happened in the last 15 days, several things continue to happen. And what the things that are happening, let's take that first in terms of COP28 in UAE. Help us understand what are the controversies and the outcomes so far. This is going to be there till December 2012. We'll come more with more in the next episode. But till now, what has happened, help us understand on this big thing that is going on.
Well, the entire project has been rife with controversy from the get-go. First of all, this has been one of in the series that attracted both a lot of attention and a lot of skepticism in the last few years. During last year, it was held in Egypt, and US and others pledged a lot of money, US alone, to Egypt for fighting climate change. That aid is yet to materialize. Others pledged a lot of money to African countries. None of it has really come through so far. Also, every year there's controversy over the fact that billionaires, kings, and CEOs of major corporations are flying in private jet planes after lecturing everyone else on taking measures to cut emissions, which is always ironic. And of course, the fact that this is taking place in the winter, and in some cases, some of these jet planes have been stopped by snow, led to amusement. This particular episode, this particular COP28 is taking place in UAE. There's been controversy over the fact that its CEO has a background in fossil fuels. Now, his argument, of course, is that fossil fuels have to work hand in hand in any electrification process, unless everyone is fully going nuclear, which is we are very far from that point. And his argument has a lot of merit, to be honest. But there is still a lot of argument over that, and whether these goals are mutually compatible, and whether he's actually honest about his intentions. But so there's been argument about that. Meanwhile, the United Nations used this occasion to create a fund for climate change, for fighting climate change, and a lot of criticism has been leveraged at the United States for supposedly not donating enough. For they claim that it donated too little. There are a lot of lofty rhetoric from Washington about this particular goal. There's also been quite a great deal of distractions, because a number of countries, their leaders, came to this event, and instead of focusing on energy and climate issues, started talking about the Israel-Hamas war, and basically using their platforms as a soapbox for unrelated political statements. So that caused a bit of disruption. The Iranian delegation left after finding out that Israelis were present, which was not unexpected given that UAE has diplomatic relations with both countries. But that highlights the tension of having diplomatic relations with countries that not only do not do not recognize each other, but one of which is dedicated to a genocide of the other state. So that puts you in a conundrum, but the show must go on. And so far, it continues, and a lot of discussions are taking place, and it's going to be a topic for a while, so we may mention additional developments in the next program.
Right, right. And what about, you know, India not signing the declaration? It has refused COP21 declaration on climate and health. How do you see that? How is the world seeing that?
Well, quite frankly, I think it, from India's perspective, this was the right thing to do, because while, you know, all these resolutions are basically aspirational and all the members still have to interpret them to adjust to their own needs and abilities, in reality, even having this as an aspiration is in some way intellectually honest, especially if you have no, especially if you prioritize this over your economic needs, you're not being honest with yourself if you're signing like that. So as far as I see, something that it could either could not deliver, or would only pretend to deliver just to get international approval, I think at the very least it's not pretending to be fighting for some cause that has no relevance to its population at the moment. And quite frankly, I think a lot of these fights are symbolic rather than real, and to the extent they're real, they're often unrealistic and damaging. So while there may be people who are claiming that India, by not signing, is not committed to a cleaner environment, I don't think it's necessarily the case. Just that climate change is not in line with every country's needs, abilities, and quite frankly, not very scientific either. So I don't think it means that India is not committed to a better environment. I just think it will go at its own rate and focus on issues that are practically relevant to the people who have to live with the consequences of this, of the balance of these issues.
Absolutely.
And I, by the way, don't think there's going to be too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be too much pushback, because at the very, because there's not much one can do. India is a growing giant. It's got over, it's got nearly 1.5 billion population. What are people going to say? Well, we want you to do something else. They can't force a country like that to do anything it doesn't want to do, to be doing. And I think the best thing they can manage is arrange, you know, continuing discussions over what best practices in various areas, of which there are many. And I don't think India is against any of that. It never rejected such conversations. We're talking about a very global, very theoretical framework that really is not very pragmatic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Talking about India, how do you look at this, you know, India-US relations in the backdrop of this Khalistani terrorism and all that stuff, and this case, an indictment, all those things happening with related to India and so-called one of the government employees getting involved into, you know, some sort of alleged assassination plot about Guru Patwar Singh Panoon. He is a designated terrorist in India. And how do you look at that now? There's some more dust, you know, flowing in the wind because of these issues. How do you look at the impact of it on India-US relations? Where do you see this going forward?
Well, to be honest, I think it can only have a very limited impact at the time, because there are bigger issues. US is not happy with the idea of its sovereignty being violated, neither would any country in its position, including India. At the same time, the legal processes are pursuing themselves. The indictment has been unsealed. There was a talk that unsealing the indictment would cause tensions. There is a lot of media speculation about whether it will, in fact, cause tensions, even disrupt the Quad participation. But as far as I see, what's done is done. What happened is happened. These conversations after what happened have occurred already. I think there's already been an agreement in place, in what we are seeing now, is we are seeing the results playing out as a result of those discussions that are already in the past. I don't think no worsening in relations beyond what has happened. I think there's probably a lot of discussions ongoing about moving forward and how to do it successfully. But from India's perspective, I believe the wisest course of action going forward is to understand that part of the outrage over this controversy is because the individual in question, while he was perceived as a terrorist and a criminal in India, is virtually unknown to Western public, and he's certainly not designated as a terrorist in the United States. So part of the problem is a complete different legal framework in which the two countries operated, which made any sort of political or legal understanding impossible in the past, and which led to this dramatic confrontation. I think that should have been avoidable. I think the wise thing going forward is to create an information campaign that informs the public and the U.S. government very publicly about the dangers of these Khalistani extremist groups and various individuals, and essentially push and lobby for the designation of relevant individuals, as terrorists, putting them on sanctions list, investigating them for crimes, extraditing them as needed, and essentially taking security measures. This perception has to change, otherwise these problems will keep festering.
Right. Staying with India, what's happening at Myanmar? Because Myanmar, all that fighting is threatening India's border security. How should we look at that? How can India do better in terms of protecting itself there?
So India, interestingly enough, has been backing the junta in Myanmar, not out of any ideological proximity to them, but because of a sense of stability. Reason being, the various rebel groups that are currently rising up, many of them are ethnically and religiously diverse and do not get along with each other. So even if the junta, which is completely undemocratic, and no one is going to claim that it's some wonderful government, has been part of the reason is it has been violating various human rights of various groups. But were it to fall, I don't think the fighting itself would end. There would be still an ongoing power struggle. So essentially, India is backing the junta as the evil scenarios. Unless there is a group of countries moving forward to sort of create some sort of a very responsible governance framework for these other rebel groups, I don't think that's going to change. But right now we're seeking the worst of two parts, the worst of all case scenarios. The junta continues to violate. It has not been pushed to in any way change its ways and to accommodate different interests and to incorporate them into some sort of a more inclusive governance model. And on the other hand, the rebels are fighting and they're being armed by various countries. Russia and China are playing both sides. They're lucratively selling weapons to everybody, and they're enjoying destabilization. China, ironically, is also backing the junta, but at the same time, certainly anything that threatens India's security plays into the hands of its rivals, such as Beijing. Then another aspect of that is the Rohingya crisis, because India has taken out in a lot of refugees, but they're also concerned that any separatist movements could inspire and fuel additional movements like the Khalistani separatism in its own border. So they're concerned about the spillover effect of these border issues, not only of the actual violence, but of the political mindset that could be detrimental to its own domestic security. So they are trying to lock down the borders and to keep apprised of anything that goes on, and hope that the crisis will be resolved. But so far, it's additional regional, local concern on top of everything else that's going on.
Right. Now let's move on to the story of Henry Kissinger. Finally, he has, he is gone. he is gone from this earth. But because a lot of people have looked at him as a war criminal, and that is why he has gotten a Nobel Peace Prize. People have loved him for that. Many people have hated him for that. So there was always a lot of, many people considered him as an American patriot, as the, one who loved the American way of life and did everything to protect it. So in that aspect, many people will look at it in their own manner. Independently, how do you look at it? Who was Henry Kissinger? Finally, how will the world remember him? How do you see it all?
It's funny. There's a saying, only the good die young. If that saying is true, Henry Kissinger, who lived to be 100, is illustrates this saying. His legacy is controversial, and for good reason. He was very much part of the, until his dying day, he never recanted his support for China and its imperial ambitions, which is terrible for the United States as an American. The global community as an American. He should have come to understand that China is never going to be argued out of looking down on everyone, including the U.S. But that's just fine. Anyone can be wrong, and it's not criminal to have wrong foreign policy views. The problem is when these wrong foreign policy views are turned into a downright, completely unethical implementation of policies, as was the case with Cambodia. We don't need to retell that story. The people there remember all too well. And of course, back in the Pakistan's abuses in Bangladesh, which of course caused a massive security problem for ancient horrific human rights abuses. So his complete disregard for human rights made him not a real politician, but quite the opposite, a very short-sighted politician who did not understand that grotesque human rights abuses turn into massive security problems, and they're detrimental toward peace and stability. So I think his legacy is wrong. All the people who are suddenly writing hagiographies of him, I have no idea who they're trying to impress. He's not even there. He had somehow become the godfather of foreign policy, and every leader and every foreign policy thinker and journalist was trying to get in on him before his death. But I don't, just because he lived a long time, just because he was successful personally as in making an impact, that doesn't make that impact desirable or good. So yes, his legacy is huge, but it's not positive. A lot of it is highly damaging, and the impact of it we are seeing to this day, in my opinion.
Right. Kissinger was, of a man of a different era altogether. Born in 1923, that was, his family had to flee from Germany during those tough times. He was, born in a Jewish family, came to the U.S., and then he went into, he fought there. He fought at the Battle of the Bulge, was part of this whole World War II, and then built his life back in the U.S., studying political science and getting into him. And the good, the thing is that whether love him or hate him, but almost every president after this, once he was in the midst, in the power corridors, they consulted him. Whatever their opinion, people in power always wanted his opinion. Even till today, he was known, famous for his shuttle diplomacy. And this continued even at this age. What was it about him that, they always needed him around? And is there another man that could take his place? Obviously, in history, there are always people around. But what was special about him? And what will the American foreign policy or diplomats will miss, or the presidents even will miss about him, about his, going away from this active life?
You know what? I'm going to say something extremely controversial. I think a lot of this presidential kowtowing to somebody whose legacy was quite wrong, quite short-sighted, quite self-serving, and sometimes downright anti-Semitic, as with the as with the time he did not want to send arms to Israel, and Nixon, who is not known for his love of Jews or Israel, had to actually intervene. You know what? If people are looking to embrace that, to virtue signal, because he was an intelligence person. He was not anyone foolish who failed to understand issues. He was wrong-handed. He was arrogant in that he refused to change his mind. And he was, I'm not even going to speculate on his motivations, but I can talk about the impact of them. And the impact was, without a question, damaging policy. And so when I see presidents go after time after time again to somebody who wasn't just wrong once or twice and admitted and reconsidered their action and is seeking the wisdom of somebody who's had to grapple with different complex problems. But when they're going to somebody who's been adamantly wrong and the principles by which he operated were wrong, it makes me wonder whether this is not the emperor is naked phenomenon, where people are afraid to admit that this fixture foreign policy is just an empty suit, someone who should be discarded, because so much of Washington is built on the policies and the legacy of the past precedents, political precedents, that are very now very difficult to dislodge. And I think this conventional way of thinking, this establishmentarianism, is serving a consequent administration is quite badly, quite poorly. I think the reason our foreign policy has gone off the rails so much and has been so entrenched in troops that need to be discarded and very short-sighted, very bubble mentality is precisely because everyone is afraid to say the emperor is naked. We need to move on from past mistakes, from past individuals, however impactful, who did damage. We have to admit that this never worked, and it's not going to work just because we try it again. Now, can we find masterful diplomats with, diverse, complex experiences? I have no doubt that one day such people will emerge. Right now, it's very difficult to say, because this is something that can only be judged in hindsight. We've had those types of diplomats before, aside from Henry Kissinger. Right now, it's very hard to say who they are, because, quite frankly, a lot of our diplomacy is very shallow, very short-sighted, very tactical, and not very impactful in a positive way. That doesn't mean that out of this morass, we won't see great diplomats in the future. Maybe they are already there, and we just don't see them. Maybe it's in the process, the history is in the process of being made. But do we necessarily need titans of wrong-headed policies just to make us feel good about ourselves? Do we need one guy, one person to tell us how to think? No, we can learn the art of diplomacy and foreign policy from various different examples and from the many hardworking people who are dedicated to promoting U.S. interests and global peace and prosperity. So I think this is something that can be found. We can learn from many different people. We don't need to just rely on a couple of big influencers in this sphere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Henry Kissinger may be gone, but he has left a lot for people to continue to talk about, especially in the last so many years. You know, the world has changed. The way he has impacted all those things, positively or negatively, people will see it in their own ways. Countries will see it in their own ways. But I'm sure a lot of people will try and understand and gain insights into what could have been done better and how we can look at foreign policy perhaps in a better manner. Be that as it may, let's move on to other issues. Let's move on to the Middle East now. What is the latest there? Is it, do we see another ceasefire happening, or is it now end? Because will it be only after the end of the Hamas leadership, as what Israel has leadership has promised?
Well, I think this we are not going to see a very fast return to any form of ceasefire. Hamas was playing games the entire time, and it managed to leverage the upper hand on Israel in many ways. It was dictating the rules of this ceasefire the entire time. It was diverting attention. It co-opted Qatar as its spokesperson and managed to get the international community pressuring Israel, not Hamas, to negotiate. And then it broke all of its own rules. The rules that it itself proposed, it broke them. It did not carry through with what it promised. It violated the ceasefire, and it also got other groups to step in and complement its efforts. So it's no wonder that all of this fell apart, and there seems to be no going back. I know Macron promised to help out, but he hasn't brought anything new to the table. Other countries, pressuring Israel can work only so far. If it's not getting anything of value in return, it makes no sense for it to listen to pressure. There's only so much everyone can do, even to Israel. And the Hamas absolutely is showing that it's nowhere near the point where it's ready to return to the table, because it simply has not been destroyed enough. Even though people are claiming the destruction has been so great, it brings us back to the military definition of proportionality, doing enough to have, taking enough action to debilitate the other party and to make it worthwhile the effort. And clearly, Hamas has not been brought to that point, probably in part because they feel that international community has been protecting them politically, probably because of the tunnels that make it difficult for Israel to reach its goals, and because of so much support from so many various state and non-state parties. That's a third factor. So Hamas is not yet in the position where it makes sense for it to come back to the table and sue for peace. And that should be the position that Hamas should be begging for peace, and should be up to Israel and its allies to determine whether that's something they're willing to give and on what terms. It should not be Hamas dictating the terms and making demands to accommodate its needs to allow time for regroup. This was the wrong thing to do. I understand why Israel did it from a humanitarian perspective, but from a security perspective, it was a mistake.
Right. So, is there any chance of, peace in the coming future, or is it then going towards a long-drawn war, which we talked about earlier on? This is what Hamas wants, to draw Israel into a long-drawn war and get as much benefit out of this. What does it look like? Will it end soon, or will the world become busy in their own thing? U.S. will soon be getting busy into its elections. The world will, and in the midst, different political parties. The warships are still in the region. The attacks are still very much on America. How will it look at that place? What will be the Iran's role and Saudi Arabia's role down there? They are talking, they are not talking. How does it look like? Even Somali pirates came into the picture. How does this whole scenario look like to be panning, out in the times to come, maybe in the next 6 months or so? How should a person, again, as I said, looking from India, should understand from this? It's very confusing indeed.
I am very much sure the political vision of Ronald Reagan and his contemporaries, meaning peace through strength. You do not arrive at peace by being weaker, by appeasing aggressors, whether they're terrorist organizations, state actors, or authoritarian individuals who've amassed too much power. You need to respond. You need to put boundaries and make it impossible for them to harm you and to operate without being destroyed and suffering very heavy consequences and deterrence. And this has not happened. It hasn't happened because Israel has not defined the threat. It defined it too narrowly. It defined it as Hamas in Gaza, but Hamas is not just in Gaza. And Gaza is not the only place place of the threat. It's just the most immediate thing that just happened. It's one location. And in my opinion, framing of it excessively focusing on Hamas and Gaza actually alienated many potential allies, because they were now, because Hamas reframed an anti-Palestinian movement versus should have been made to see as an anti-terrorist, anti-extremist movement, global and threatening to the entire region. It also hasn't happened because US is still pursuing a confused and wrong-headed policy, chasing after some mythical deal with Iran that nobody even knows what it is. It's no longer a nuclear deal. We don't even know what's happening with that, whether Iran has now attained its goals or not, because everyone's been so focused on the war. So we don't know what US is actually trying to get from Iran. And until we define what it is we want from them, what kind of agreement or framework, we can't attain an objective without, you know, if we don't define it, we can't develop a strategy. So right now there's no strategy. There's no, the tactical response is mixed and very weak at best. And so US now is being increasingly drawn into a conflict that it didn't choose, because it's refusing to respond with force that would prevent further attacks. So it may end up it's in a much more escalated conflict precisely because it failed to respond quickly and early enough. We, in 6 months from now, we may be facing a much more global war. Not a nuclear war necessarily, not an organized war of states, you know, sending their armies, but an asymmetrical, prolonged and broader conflict with many more stakeholders and proxies and all, for sure. Unless you know, Israel and US reframe their own actions, reframe the conflicts and start operating smarter.
Right. How do you look at the role of Qatar? Sometimes it looks like to be helping everyone from an outside perspective. Sometimes it looks like it is so clued into everything. How should the world understand Qatar? And also, the role of Turkey. Erdogan, he doubles down on Hamas support, and there is also all that pressure to expel Hamas plotters. So how do you look at these roles of these two players down, very important players in the region? How should we understand? And when you are talking of nukes, I also want you to address this whole thing about Taliban also wants to have nukes, to obtain top tactical nukes. What does it mean, you know, for the new regional security, and what will it do with these nukes? Do they have the power to control the, you know, that thing which requires a lot of responsibility, a lot of, you know, positive way to keep it contained so that it does not fall into the wrong hands?
Well, Qatar is a mafia family with a country. It's 300,000 of native population, as one tribe controlling all of them, several tribes under them that are given special privileges, and everybody else essentially treated as second class citizen. So what do? They sell their services to whomever is buying. US wanted the Taliban and Hamas to have political offices. They happily agreed to it and went far beyond what they were asked, in actually becoming main sponsors of terrorist organizations. And they create fires that then they help put out in an entirely self-serving and highly damaging way, which a way that allows the bad actors to get away with murder and pretending that somehow they created peace after negotiating with people who should never be negotiated with and who should never have been legitimized in any way. So they're actually helping legitimize, organizations like Taliban, like Houthis, like Hamas. They're helping legitimize Iran and helping legitimize themselves in that particular way. So yeah, that's all we need to know. They feed on corruption, they feed on blackmail, they feed on alliances with the stronger rogue regimes with more power, and they feed on the fact that no one knows what to do with them and is afraid of confronting them for various reasons. There's no political will. As far as Turkey goes, Turkey is in a highly advantageous position because of its NATO standing and close relations with Russia, with Iran on many issues, and so forth. So Erdogan can play these games, or feels he can play with games, and he can play them more the less US refuses to confront those other issues. Turkey would be far less able to manipulate anybody had NATO and US taken the lead on confronting Russia, confronting Iran fully, and not have to depend on other countries to do to help on some of these issues? Had they taken action to prevent these countries from becoming a problem to begin with, you wouldn't need Turkey to then help block some of them or try to manipulate them. So essentially, Turkey gets away with what it does because US and others are giving so much leeway to everybody else. If we decide to get serious, we'll start with those countries first, and then we'll get to middle powers like Turkey that are using these issues to their advantage in the worst possible way, and we will simply tell them, okay, you want this, you will, our conditions are that, and that's it. But until we get serious about our priority issues, Turkey and Qatar and, you know, and various other countries will take advantage of us and create and use our needs to their advantage.
Right. Before I come again, you know, about the Taliban, talking about, you know,
Taliban, yes.
I will come to that. Before that, help us understand how long can the U.S. warships be in that region? Because if it's going to take long, other countries have also sent in their troops in that region. So what happens to that? Will the U.S. warships continue to be stationed there? Or if they pull it out, again, what will be the situation there? Does it look like, how does that possibility look like, pulling out or staying there for a long haul?
Well, their role was supposed to deter terrorist organizations from escalating. The problem is it's not working because US's bark is bigger than its bite. It's not willing to use the power that it's seeking to attack with force, and so these organizations are not taking this deterrent signal seriously. Moreover, U.S. is in danger of getting trapped there because now Iran is taking over islands in the Bab al-Mandab area, which provide the only exit point for one of its warships. So if it gets stuck there, U.S. will be drawn into a direct conflict with Iran. That is not something anybody wants. It is not desirable. Yes, U.S. Navy is far superior to Iran's, but how will it do against terrorism from multiple sides? I don't know, and I don't really want to find out. This is something that should be dealt with right now before it becomes an issue. Overall, the plan for it is to, you know, the problem is U.S. has no strategy for putting this whole situation to an end. So while the answer may be as long as it's needed, nobody needs. You need to know what steps are needed to not make this another forever war, how to de-escalate, how to roll back the influence of Iran and its proxies. That should be the answer. There should be a timeline that should be framed by US and NATO and not by Iran and its allies. But I don't believe we have any of that in place.
Right. Now, talking of Taliban, about they say to be, you know, trying to obtain near tactical nukes. Why do they need these nukes? For who is their enemy? And what will they do? Do they have the wherewithal to first buy it? Who will sell them? And secondly, where will they keep it? Because it needs a lot of responsible handling of these things.
I should note that Taliban is not the only one seeking nukes. Al-Qaeda expressed such an interest as well, and I think the result would be about the same because the organizations are very similar and have been partners in the past, and they're continuing a very profound level of cooperation. Al-Qaeda is flourishing in Afghanistan. So Taliban, if asked, Taliban will say that their enemies are ISIS-K, their enemies are on occasion Iran, etc. None of it is true because ISIS-K, the occasional struggle for power, but they're very similar and they've helped each other out in the past, certainly against the West. Iran has backed Taliban when it was convenient and continues to work with them on occasion. So I don't think Taliban has any interest in fighting a nuclear war with Iran. and certainly not with ISIS-K within its own territory. I think, unfortunately, those tactical weapons would be used against other regional powers and possibly could be traded with other Iran proxies or Islamist groups in the region, maybe some of the Pakistan-backed groups, if they ask for it. Storing it would be problematic. I think Pakistan could be able to help them figure out how to store it. You know, some of the enriched uranium has disappeared from Pakistani soil and ended up in strange places like the Heathrow Airport, which Pakistan has denied. But we all remember the AQ Khan situation. We don't want a repetition of that, but Afghanistan seems a very likely purchaser of such services. And where there was one precedent, there could be very well be another. This is grossly irresponsible. It's horrifying. They're not the responsible actor. You know, whenever people are afraid of Russian threats, Russia is by far the more rational actor, even at its worst. The Taliban not only is not rational by our standards, it also doesn't know what it's doing. It has zero experience with handling such weapons. It has shown a gross level of responsibility with handling far less dangerous weapons that the Americans left behind, and it's a possibility no one really wants. Unfortunately, with Taliban in power, with it likely becoming normalized by many countries, it is that much closer to having the legitimate means to obtain such weapons.
Right, right. Let's move on to Taiwan and China. So the elections, the upcoming elections in Taiwan, how do you see that? Is it a three-way split, in Taiwan in terms of elections? So how do you see, is it a good situation for China? It will take as much advantage as possible. How do you look at it?
Well, the Taiwan elections took an unexpected turn. We are now facing a three-way race. One of the opposition parties largely collapsed, which is not all that surprising, given that a lot of these opposition parties are pro-peace dialogue with China, and much of the population. The population is about half and half, but there is an increasing edge against peace talks with China out of security concerns. And as I've repeatedly stated in various places, I don't believe that China's first choice is military invasion. If they can avoid a military confrontation with the possible involvement of many different actors and different sides, they will. So their first choice is to meddle in elections, to instigate coups, to try to take over Taiwan politically, to try to take over public opinion in its favor. And that's exactly where it's going to be focusing its efforts for until January, when the elections are expected to take place. While I do not, while there will be election observers and support of all kinds, the exercise of soft power of these sort of active measures is something China, with Russia's help, excel in, and U.S. is far less adept at preventing than they are at direct response to some military crisis. Yes, they can sell Taiwan weapons quietly. They can, put all sorts of boundaries, but political involvement, I'm not sure we have the resources, the wherewithal to fight these political games long term. Maybe we have some capability, but I am not convinced, because the fact that this is even a question at this point, after all the threats that China made to Taiwan itself, shows that it has achieved far more success politically than anyone cares to admit.
Right, right. The last topic that I want to touch, based on Irina, is that you are a, information warfare specialist. You know about how those things work. Help us understand all this, global wave of cybercrime and attacks happening all around. Is it coincidence, coordination, or something in between? What exactly should we understand about all these things? Are we secure at all, or are we not, even a common person like me?
So I think several things are happening at once. First of all, when you have multiplying global crises, they create opportunities for various actors, regular criminals who are just opportunistically feeding on distraction and you know, weaknesses, and state actors seeking advantage, and semi, you know, mercenary actors who will work for whoever is paying them, be they stakeholders in a conflict or crime groups or so forth, and also semi-state actors who, on the one hand, are affiliated with some political agendas, but are also pursuing their own private interests as well on the side. So all of this is multiplied exponentially, and there's increasing growing coordination among these actors due to globalization of communications, crime, and law enforcement, due to the fact that there is a fluidity in global threats, and there is a increased interaction between different actors, and they cooperate a lot more, and also because of increased opportunities. So on the one hand, you do have more independent agendas just happening simultaneously, not as a complete coincidence, but due to observation of the impact and successes of others. They're inspired by each other, they're inspired by the opportunities, by the success, by the distraction of law enforcement, by the inability of the private and public sector to keep up with these threats. And the more there are, the easier there is to increase impact, because you can't chase down every ransomware attack or every phishing attack all over the world. And there's only so much resources you could put in when you're constantly overwhelmed with new threats. It makes it easier. The more crime you have, the less effective you are at fighting crime, the more crime will proliferate. Similarly with terrorism and any political threats as well. So we are seeing both direct coordination between politically aligned actors who are pursuing the opportunities in that way through coalition building, and more opportunism that's not necessarily directly coordinated, but very much inspired and very much enthused by the opportunities.
Right. There is a lot of things happening in the world at the same war, including war, cyber warfare, a lot of things on internet as well as on the ground. And we will continue to bring all the analysis with you, as you know, as this happens every week, every second week. With this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Lives, the World According to Irina Sukerman. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.